Hello, and welcome to the Next Stage Press podcast, where we talk theater and playwriting with various playwrights of Next Stage Press. I'm your host, Gene Cato, and for the next half hour or so, we'll be speaking with Georgia playwright John Patrick Bray about his experience turning a classic of literature into a new stage version, his experience in turning one of his plays into a feature film, as well as the appeal for crafting plays based on pre-existing source material. John, hello, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Gene. Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. I am very thrilled to get you on the podcast finally. I know that your teaching schedule has been you're down there full go down there in Georgia. So I appreciate you taking little bit of time out of your busy schedule to be able to talk with us. So let me get going on this. One of the things that I always like to do at the very beginning is have the playwrights just kind of tell us a little bit about themselves and how they got from birth to this moment right here. So if you would give us a brief history of John Patrick Bray.
Sure. I was born in Hackensack, New Jersey. I am an identical twin. I grew up mostly in the Hudson Valley, New York. My dad is a car salesman. My mom worked at different retail stores and stuff. And my parents said to my brother and I, we want you guys to go to college, but, it's going to be up to you guys to figure out, how to do it. And also, you can also decide your major. And so we went to Dutchess Community College in Poughkeepsie and, where we studied communication and media art. At that point, I thought I either wanted to be a cameraman for like Channel 6 in the Hudson Valley, local channel, or that I would want to be a radio DJ. And one night I was in the editing booth putting together a project, and it was kind of late. I'm not even sure if I was supposed to still be there. And I went outside and I saw a group of theater kids kind of singing and stuff. And I gravitated over towards them, and in no time flat, I became a member of the drama club. Because I'd done some theater in high school and loved it, but this notion of, no, there's more to theater than just high school just hadn't hit me. And so I had a great time at the drama club there, finished up a bachelor's at SUNY New Paltz with a focus in acting and directing, went to the Actors Studio Drama School at the New School for my MFA in playwriting, and there I got essentially two educations. There was the education by day in the classroom, with a lot of method-based exercises, some wonderful teachers there, and then the education at night, where I went downtown New York or to the Brooklyn Academy of Music and checked out some really great theater in quirky little spaces or in really big spaces. And and during that time, I found that I had I loved my teachers. I thought they had awesome lives. I desperately wanted to be a college teacher. And so I started off as an adjunct and worked at a couple of colleges, and by hook or by crook, made it to Louisiana, kind of a long story, and finished up a PhD in theater at LSU, and now I'm teaching here at Georgia. And I'm still writing plays, and I'm teaching theater. It's great. It's been a really great and crazy ride. I think my parents were a little bit worried when I got into the New School, because, they said, hey, you can major in anything you like and just go ahead. We just want to make sure you guys go to college and have a chance to get ahead. And so right. This notion of I'm going to sink my future, sink all kinds of debt into being a playwright. and so they were not what they had in mind.
Right. Every parent's dream to hear that, right? Sometimes, yeah.
It really is, yeah. My dad loved theater. He was, and still is very much, kind of an armchair song and dance man at this point, but he loved being involved in community shows back in the 90s. And my mother was always singing around the house too, so we were very much a theater feeling family. And my uncle Pat was one of the founders of the Washington Center for Performing Arts, and he was also chairman of John F. Kennedy's ball. And so there's just something about theater kind of being in the blood wherever we just happen to be, and, whether we're teachers or salespeople, or I was a bagel baker for 6 years, like theater is just always somehow there. I just moved forward with it, and I'm really glad that I have.
Yeah, now you're the second playwright that we've interviewed so far that teaches theater. down in Georgia. And playwright Daniel Guyton, he talked a little bit, because you guys are at two completely different schools. So tell us a little bit about what the theater is like in the surrounding area around, you're in Athens, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, tell us what a little bit about the theater community that's around the Athens area.
In Athens, there are community theaters. There's the Town and Gown Players, which does mostly established shows. They have their own space. There's the Circle Ensemble in Winterville, and they have a play reading series called Their Second Sundays. They also produce established shows, Shakespeare mostly. There is the Rose of Athens. They do touring productions to local schools. There's a fringe festival here. It's been here a couple of years. The guys put it together, and most of that stuff is like bring your own venues. You find a space, you sign it out, and so that's a classic city fringe. And then there are, you know, there's the Athens Playwrights Workshop, which I started, which is a group of us playwrights get together at the University of Georgia. You don't have to be affiliated with UGA to participate. And it's on alternating Monday nights where we bring in like 10 pages of a script at a time that we're working on, and we share feedback and donuts, and you know, and everybody's invited. So even folks who don't write plays that just like to hang out with us and hear the plays and have a donut and have the camaraderie, it really is open to everybody.
That sounds great.
Yeah, so that's kind of it. In terms of the, you know, larger theater scene, it's funny that Athens doesn't have like a does not have a big theater scene, because we have a big food scene, of course, a big music scene with REM and B-52s and Drive-By Truckers and other bands coming out of here. But we don't have a big theater scene. So for our theater needs, we tend to drive to Atlanta, where there's a very, you know, vibrant theater scene there.
All right. All right. Well, let's. I want to turn the conversation a little bit and talk a little bit about you. You have several plays that Next Stage Press has published, but let's go back a little bit and talk about the first play that we published. Now, the first play that Next Stage Press published of yours was a play called Hound. And can you talk about your kind of unique take on this work? It's based on a well-known classic story, but I'd like for you to talk about kind of your take on it, its origins, and why it offers theater companies kind of a new look at a classic tale.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So Hound is adapted or inspired by the Sherlock Holmes story, The Hound of the Baskervilles. And I kind of have a long history of loving Sherlock Holmes. When I was a kid in elementary school in upstate New York, I was asthmatic. And so during the winters, it was best that I stay indoors. And I'm sure that the science has changed, but back then, dominant idea was, okay, if you have asthma, it's winter, stay inside. And so I remember third and fourth grade just watching all the old Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce movies and really becoming enamored with those. And it wasn't until 10th grade. Now, we read some stories, not in elementary school, but middle school. We read the, The Redheaded League and the Speckled Band, which were fun, kind of silly, but fun. And when I got in high school and I read Hound of the Baskervilles, and it really blew my mind. And I was talking to my 10th grade teacher, and he said, hey, did you ever watch the show with Jeremy Brett, Edward Hardwick, and David Burke, the Granada series? And I said, no, I really like the Basil Rathbones. And he said, you know what, give it a chance. And so I did, and the first episode I saw was The Final Problem, where Sherlock Holmes, you know, dies. And then the next episode the following week was Empty House, where he comes back. And I just thought the show was sensational. So I became addicted to that show, and then I wanted to see every single version of Sherlock Holmes, every single version of The Hound of the Baskervilles, and there's some that I kind of liked, some I didn't like, but I never found one that I truly loved. And so that's part of it. So fast forward to 2004, I had just graduated from the New School. By this point, I joined two Scion societies of the Baker Street Irregulars, the Blue Carbuncle, but I didn't stay with them as long. I was there for one of their Christmas dinners. It was just a kind of a commute. And then the Hudson Valley Scientists, led by Lou Lewis. And I ended up reading a play by a mentor, Neil Bell, called Monster, which was his adaptation of Frankenstein. And I just thought it was so beautiful in its visual poetry and command of language. And having worked with Neil, you know, it felt like he was the person that gave me permission to be a playwright. I had some really wonderful teachers throughout grad school and throughout undergrad, but something about me and Neil Bell really clicked. And so 2004, I was actually going through a little bit of a crisis, and I was trying to focus on, you know, something that I could do just artistically to get me through this crisis. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to see a stage play of Hound of the Baskervilles, where you really don't need a set, where it relies entirely on the language, where the some of the issues were a little more contemporary, and something where, you know, somebody once said to me, oh, I see you've written a comedy. It's like, well, actually, it's not really a comedy. And somebody else said, oh, you've written something that's absurd. It's like, well, I don't know if it's absurd. You know, it might be. I mean, certainly there are moments that are funny. Certainly there are moments that are absurd. But just something that played with theatricality in a new way. And in terms of the story, if you read Hound of the Baskervilles, you know, long story short, wealthy landowners plagued by a hellhound. And Sherlock Holmes shows up with Watson to, you know, find out what the deal is with this hellhound. And Holmes kind of takes a powder and disappears for most of the book, and then comes back and says, aha, I figured out the case. Look, it's not really a hellhound. It's some cousin you didn't know about trying to get the estate from afar. And, you know, you see that, Sir Henry, there's no such thing as a hellhound, and justice has prevailed. And you have these character types who are, you know, very much protected by the kind of people that they are. And, you know, in this kind of genre, this detective genre. You know, so, I mean, good story. And it was published in between Final Problem and Empty House. So Doyle had killed off Holmes in the adventure of the Final Problem. He and Moriarty both die going over Reichenbach Falls. And then Doyle wrote Hound of the Baskervilles. He was actually thinking about, some years later, in fact, he was thinking about, you know, writing a new detective, creating some new characters. And then he thought, well, you know, I've got Holmes. Maybe I can just do like a serialized novel for The Strand, just to say, hey, remember this character? And, you know, and it's based on the success of that and William Gillette's stage play that The Strand basically showed up with a truckload of money and said, please, for love of God, bring him back. And Doyle did with The Empty House. And so what I thought was, well, what happens if we situate The Hound of the Baskervilles instead of being a story that takes place before Final Problem, if we situate it as a story that takes place just after? And a line that caught my attention in The Empty House, if you read it, is Watson, you know, all the stories are told from the point of view of Watson. And in The Empty House, Watson tells us it's been 3 years since he's seen Sherlock Holmes, and now there's a murder case that Scotland Yard's investigating, and Watson's been called in as a police doctor and had to give some testimony, and you know, it was just like a very bizarre case. And then suddenly Holmes shows up. He's like, hey, look, I'm not actually dead, and here's how I survived the fall with Moriarty, and here's why I've been hiding, because Moriarty's right-hand man, Sebastian Moran, he's the guy that committed this murder, and I've been waiting for him to mess up so I can catch him, because if I let him know I'm still alive, he would have assassinated me on sight. And, I mean, that's kind of a thin story, but you could tell that Doyle was like, you know, I have to come up with something.
Right.
And but in that passage, Watson says something like, you know, Holmes had learned of my own bereavement, and he reassured me and said, well, you know, yes, Watson, but, you know, he says something like, you know, it's, I understand you're sad, but let's get back to work. And so within like two sentences, and without mentioning her name, Arthur Conan Doyle killed off Watson's wife. That was Watson's bereavement. So it's like, wait a second, did Mary Morrison just die and we didn't even get we got nothing? Like, that's it? That's the crumb we're left? And so for Hound of the Baskervilles, they kind of changed it up so that Watson now is a grieving widower and Holmes is back to life, and Holmes' approach is a case for involving this hellhound. And instead of Watson being used by Holmes as a tethered goat, as he is in the story, I said, well, wouldn't it be interesting if Watson was like, hellhound, life after death, my wife is dead. You know what? I'm going to go out and I'm going to see that hellhound and prove the existence of the afterlife. And maybe, just maybe, this thing can lead me into, you know, into hell or wherever that I can find, you know, my deceased Mary. And so it's very, becomes this kind of surreal and colorful and kind of dark world as Watson goes on this quest. And we meet these character types like the maid, you know, Mrs. Hudson, or like the Barrymores, the butler and the maid over at Baskerville Hall. We meet the murderer, and each character kind of addresses the audience and explains why they have to do what they do within the confines of this world. So there's a little bit of fourth wall breaking. And so rather than the characters being protected by who they are in these detective story where science and reason wins out and we all triumph, these characters are kind of damned by what they are. Oh. And so that when Holmes shows up at the end, it's like, hey, look, it was just a dog. You see that? There's no afterlife. I mean, good news for Henry, bad news for Watson.
Right.
And so it's a very different tone to the story. And, you know, I think I was reading a lot of Strindberg at that point, too. I can't help but think that maybe I was reading a dream play by Strindberg and really like, whoa, you know, with how he situates this kind of, you know, symbolist / expressionist quest.
But right.
Anyway, so that's kind of where Hound the Pound came from, was just lots of theatricality. You know, thinking a little bit too long and hard about three stories by Doyle. And just to wish to see it produced on, you know, using some light changes, using like an easel with some placards. And we did it in 2007 at the Cité des Arts in Lafayette, Louisiana. And then it had, excuse me, an off-Broadway run as part of the Planet Connection Theater Festivity directed by Rachel Klein, who's just a genius. And, yeah, since then, I know it's been produced again down in Lafayette, and folks have been buying the script, and hopefully they'll pick it up maybe for next Halloween.
Yeah, when you think of, you know, Sherlock Holmes stories, you just kind of in your mind you picture, you know, deep realism, and you know, I mean these stories they kind of have a visual component to them. And so that's very interesting that you decided to take this story into this completely, you know, almost surrealistic, you know, way of telling it, you know, and
sure.
Gives a completely different, feel to, you know, these characters, you know, that we typically know, you know, just in a particular fashion of actually experiencing them. So, and also for theater companies, that's got to be also terrific. It kind of opens it up to, you know, interpretation on exactly how to stage it.
Yeah. And in terms of the realism, I mean, that was a product of the serialized novels of the 19th up until the very early 20th centuries where, the person writing the story wants to convince you, the reader, that this is something that really happened.
Right.
And lays out evidence. Gaston Leroux, of course, would do the same thing with his serialized Phantom of the Opera, where it was released a chapter a month, and which audiences absolutely loved. And Leroux was a journalist, and so he was writing the Phantom of the Opera. Was, you know, saying, hey, guess what? This opera phantom really exists. And now I should probably transition here with Phantom of the Opera. My play, Eric, A Play About a Puppet, is also published with Next Stage Press. And mostly because I was just really obsessed with Phantom of the Opera, which is why I wrote the story. But going back to Gaston Leroux, when he wrote his Phantom of the Opera, he actually had been reading these kind of tell-all stories, autobiographies published by theater managers who wanted to give the gossip of what was really happening at the Paris Opera and other opera houses. And at the Paris Opera, there was this apocryphal story about a young male ballet dancer who had fallen in love from afar with a lead ballet dancer. And she was seeing, I forget his rank, but he was somebody in the military. And this guy in the military found out that this young male opera singer had fallen in love with his girlfriend. And so he beat the guy up, beat the male ballet dancer up, and tied him up outside against the Paris Opera. And, overnight, over a cold winter night, and next morning somebody found him tied up, brought him back to his home, and he was dying from exposure and essentially said, bury my bones in the catacombs beneath the Paris Opera House so that I may be forever close to my love. And so the tale is that they did bury his bones, and that the piece they were performing was some variation of the opera The Marksman, which is a popular German folk opera. And why that was kind of cool for me is that as a kid, the first Broadway musical I was exposed to was the Phantom of the Opera, the Andrew Lloyd Webber, very ornate, melodramatic, musical, operatic musical. And then the next piece I was exposed to as a teenager that I fell in love with was the Black Rider, which was a Robert Wilson, Tom Waits, William S. Burroughs piece that had been at the Brooklyn Academy of Music and was also in Germany. And at one point, maybe 15 years ago, there was a production in San Francisco with Marian Faithfull. I mean, it's a very bizarre musical if you're not used to kind of expressionism on stage.
Sure.
And so it's a long way of saying that the two reasons why I got involved in theater, what really made me click, even before hanging out in college and saying, okay, I will dedicate myself to this, were the Webber Phantom of the Opera and the Wilson Waits Black Rider, and both come from the same apocryphal bones beneath the opera house, because the Black Rider is an adaptation of The Marksman, which is the piece that they're performing. So,
oh wow, really?
I don't know. That might be kind of a lengthy footnote, but yeah, but that kind of
No, it's okay. That's very interesting. Since you kind of opened the gate on this, I'm going to jump ahead to a question and then we're going to come back to something. So both Hound and Eric, a play about a puppet, they use pre-existing source material. You have Hound that has the Hound of the Baskerville. Eric, a play about a puppet, uses the Phantom of the Opera as its kind of jumping off point. So what are the challenges that you face when you're writing from the standpoint of, using pre-existing material to create a new play, and what's the appeal to you personally?
Well, I'll start with the appeal. The appeal is that, when you love something so much that if you have the opportunity, especially because those two works are in common domain, to play with it, you kind of, it's just fun. Who would turn that down?
Right.
Sherlock Holmes, I'd be hard pressed to say that there's some version of Phantom of the Opera that I haven't either seen or read or listened to. As a small kid in Jersey, second grade, I remember there was a series of action figures that were released that were the Universal Monster movies action figures. So they're like the standard, 3 3/4 inch figures with they had Bela Lugosi's Dracula, Boris Karloff's Frankenstein's monster, Boris Karloff's mummy, the Lon Chaney Jr. Wolfman, but then the Lon Chaney Sr. Phantom of the Opera. And I had a friend in second grade who sold me the action figure for like 50 cents. It was like a bake sale or something that day. And I had 2 quarters and I was like, I will forego donuts. I need that toy. It's so cool. And so, so I've been playing with this toy for years. So this notion that, that theater is another way to kind of play with your toys.
Sure.
Which is great. The other part of it is that with Phantom of the Opera and Sherlock Holmes, most people are familiar with the stories. I mean, especially Sherlock Holmes now with the success of Sherlock and Elementary and, Ken Ludwig's Baskerville, and that there are, that most people are familiar with Holmes. So that if you say, hey, we're doing a Sherlock Holmes play, folks have an expectation when they show up to the theater And then hopefully you'll find a way to play with those expectations so they don't just say, okay, it was just another Sherlock Holmes play, or just another, you know, the challenge is to say something new that somebody else hasn't already said using that material.
Right.
The other appeal, of course, is that, hey, the story's already been written.
Right. Kind of a built-in audience, at least, with that.
Yeah, and a built-in plot, too.
Right.
So if you have trouble writing plot, I recommend writing adaptations. But for Phantom, and the reviews are really, really good for Hound when it was in when it had its limited run in downtown New York. Now, with Phantom, it does not, I discovered, have the same kind of legacy with audiences, you know, that most people younger than me have not seen the Lon Chaney version or the Claude Rains or Herbert Lom or, you know, Pitcher version. They haven't seen it. They just know the Andrew Lloyd Webber. And so we don't have that kind of cultural attachment to Phantom that we do to Sherlock. And so folks who came to see Eric, if they expected like a, you know, a cheaper version of the Andrew Lloyd Webber, they're going to be woefully disappointed. Because Eric also does its own kind of work, where I just thought about, you know, a puppet, right? Like, what does it mean to be a puppet? We throw that word around a lot. We say, oh, political puppets, or a puppet for this person, puppet for that person. And, you know, and a term of affection in the late 19th century was puppet with an O, meaning puppet, where, you know, a male might say that to a woman, you know, or a child or something. And so, slowly but surely, I just saw this Phantom character being played by a series of puppets, and that it never actually spoke. It would only sing maybe a couple of times, but would never actually speak. And so it kind of started there. And from there, I brought in the framing device of a sideshow carnival, which was more to my nod to the Black Rider than to Love Never Dies. It wasn't until later somebody pointed out, like, hey, you know that Lloyd Webber's sequel, Love Never Dies, takes place at a carnival. It's like, oh, son of a gun. No, I didn't know. But I do now. I've seen it since. So that was kind of just the first frame, is like, you know, wrestling with issues of who controls whom, wrestling with issues of beauty, you know, what do we consider beautiful? Because part of the Phantom, right, is that he's this horribly disfigured man that's been shunned by society. So that whole I'm abhorrent, don't look at me, I'm going to wear a mask. He becomes the monster that other people see. And so it's like, okay, so let's play with that, you know, beauty, ugliness, and really put that in the foreground. And, you know, and the last part of it is that there's a detective character who's in the book and in various, versions of the story that Lloyd Webber took out. And I love him for the detective character. I kind of went back to, Jean-Luc Godard's film Detective. It's like, what happens if you have like this Jean-Luc Godard-esque character just dropped into this world, a carnival sideshow, a 19th century opera house? And there's kind of a beauty and ugliness there from the sideshow to the opera house, and see how he can add to the mixture. And so it became a really wild ride. And the Rising Sun Performance Company, where I'm a resident writer in downtown New York, was so generous to put this show up for the Frigid Festival at the Crane Theater in 2015, and it was just a ball. It was directed by Jared Bogard, and just really strong performances. We had a Bon Raku puppet, and it was wild.
Wow.
it was a very it was a wild time, and there were folks that absolutely loved it, folks who really did not. There was actually a critic who came to see it, who is a Wall Street lawyer by day, and she said that she'd rather, in her review, she said she'd rather blow up the theater than watch the last 10 minutes of the play. And, I was thinking about what Wall Street has done to our collective blood pressure for the past 20 years, so you're welcome, America. And, if you can get a Wall Street lawyer to threaten domestic violence, you know you've written a good play.
Right.
But we had a cult audience. It became like a cult play. We actually had the Obie Award-winning Horse Trade Theater produced an extended run of the show after the Frigid Festival was over, because there are people that came back two or three times. And, you know, somebody said to me during one of the last performances, you know, did you mean to write a cult hit when you wrote Eric a Play About a Puppet? I was like, no, I didn't know who this was for, to be honest. I was hoping that somebody would see it. And, you know, so that was just a really cool byproduct that we had this like mini cult hit. And, you know, hopefully folks will bring it back, because it's, you know, kind of campy, kind of burlesque, and kind of dark, but a hell of a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to write, and the production was a lot of fun as well.
Well, that's great. So we'll jump from the impressionistic and go a little bit to the realistic here. You also have a play with us called Liner Notes that's been very popular, and it was recently turned into a film. Can you talk a little bit about the differences in working on a play version versus a film version of the play, and also how did that come about?
Sure. So I wrote Liner Notes when I was 24. It was in the middle of my time at grad school. It's a new school. And I wrote it for Jeffrey Sweet's playwriting class, and then Jack Elber's playwriting unit. There was like a unit where he'd bring things into directors and actors and stuff. And it started there. And when I was in my 20s and going to school, I loved theater, but I really loved records. I mean, I was a big audiophile. And so I spent a lot of time at some of the great record stores in downtown New York, Generations over on Thompson, which I think is still there, Subterranean on Cornelia, which is gone, Kim's Video's gone, Rebel's gone. I worked at a record shop very briefly, Rhino Records, New Paltz, New York, and so I was just absorbing all this music and reading a lot of biographies and autobiographies about some of my favorite musicians and bands. And so when the play started, it was like a cast of eight people, and through workshops at the Actor's Studio and then the Epic Rep at the Players Club and Last Frontier Theater Conference, just kind of brought around a lot of places, it slowly became like a two-person play. And that's kind of what it needed to be, was just a two-person play. And in my mind, the male is really inspired by Sterling Morrison, who was a guitar player for Velvet Underground. And with time, the younger female in the play became Frances Bean Cobain, the daughter of the late Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love. And so just trying to figure out what their journey would be together, what their conflict would be. It was just I couldn't write liner notes now because it is very, very realistic, and most of the stuff right now isn't realistic, but it was, a product of my love of some of these really rich and wonderful bands from the 60s, 70s, and 80s and into the early 90s. And so that was the play. It was produced off Broadway with the Redirection Theater Company. And recently was produced at Onion Man Productions in Chamblee, Georgia. The film came about, my twin brother is a professor of digital media at SUNY New Paltz. And he and I have talked for years about making a film together. And so one day he called me up and said, you know, we've talked about it long enough. Let's just go ahead. Let's just make something, you know. He said, of the things of yours that I've seen or read, the one that feels the most like a movie is Liner Notes, because it's kind of a car trip movie. And, you know, on stage, we see the characters when they're not driving, because it's kind of hard to stage driving in a way that actually, it's theatrical. And so he said, so let's see what happens if we do this as a road trip movie. And I said, sure. So I went ahead and I rewrote the play as a screenplay. And with the screenplay, you know, you can't really make a two-person film. It doesn't work. And so it was like, all right, so we need more characters. I'd written a couple of short plays. One was called Cover Magnets. One was called Watery Grave. And they both had the same characters, but at like a, you know, it was like the band at a younger age. And so I brought those into the screenplay. We fleshed it out a little bit with some other, you know, oddballs I made along the way. And then I sent it to my brother, and he rewrote a bunch just because he was thinking in terms of what would work, what would be visual, what wouldn't work. And then he sent it back my way, and then I did a draft, and he did a draft. And then we argued back and forth, you know, the healthy kind of collaborative arguments. And then he shot it. He used a red cam. This was the summer of 2014. He shot it. He used a red cam and got Alan Enlow and Alyssa Carpenter. And Alan's been acting for years in various different projects. He has a very, very neat resume. He even voiced the Joker in one of the many Batman video games. And Alyssa Carpenter was herself a producer and writer and actor already. She had an independent film called Ma Hong of the West. And something else she worked on. I'm sorry, it's escaping me at the moment. And so he brought these two actors in. And he shot it in, I think it was actually 18 days.
Wow.
And then we had a company here doing B-roll, Dominar Films in Athens, Georgia. And the music, he approached a couple of bands in New Paltz, New York that have been around for a while, and Danny Aces and Tiger Piss and a few others, and they did the soundtrack. And parts of it were shot in the bagel shop where I've worked. Parts of it were shot in the bar where I very briefly had a house band. Parts of it were shot at my parents' house.
All over the place.
Yeah, it was very, as I was watching, it's very, much more of an autobiography than I had expected. But it worked really well as a film. I think the screenplay works much differently than the play, and it works pretty well as a film.
Yeah.
So,
all right. Yeah. Well, we're coming up on a little time, but on the time limit here, but I want to be able to drop in on one or two other things briefly. You have a play with us called Donkey that deals with kind of corporations and politics muscling in on a small coffee shop in a college town. So how did that play come about?
That came about because where I lived in upstate New York, there had been an independent coffee shop that we all like to go to. And that really happened, that somebody announced, hey, Starbucks is moving to the center of the town. The folks who rented Starbucks the property undercharged them by a lot and actually locked them into this very long-term lease at truly not enough money. And the concern was, well, with this big coffee shop coming into town, could the small one survive? And the answer, I think, would have been yes, if the people associated with that small town coffee shop hadn't lost their minds. And it was crazy, you know. And we were at a place where, the major retail stores where you can buy things like socks and underwear were like a half hour away. And then we heard, oh no, Walmart wants to come into town. It's like, well, do we want a Walmart here? They'll take away the jobs or kill our economy. But no, we don't want that. But we actually do want socks and underwear. And so it was those kind of, negotiations of independent shops versus corporate America. And that was the beginning of the play. So it actually came from someplace real. And then I tried to present the characters so that, so we could see all their points of views. I mean, they all behave terribly throughout the play, but my hope is that they're likable and that when they have a point of view, we don't suddenly turn around and say, oh, now, wait a second, I didn't want to present straw man arguments.
Right.
I wanted to present really, honest arguments in small town America that are happening, that continue to happen, about, what to do with the rise of corporate powers and the death of small businesses. And how does that affect the local economy when the locals really need some of the basics that they're not getting with the mom and pop operations? So that was and that was also another challenge for me, because I'd been writing Hound and Eric and some other things. Like, well, can I go back and do something, one room,
right?
Realistic.
No scene and, changes, just one location.
Yeah, just one location. Yeah, and so it worked. It's been produced a couple of times, and I've been happy. I've been happy with it. Yeah.
Great. Okay, well, I want to give us a few minutes here. Your newest play, Friendly's Fire, is going to open in New York soon. Well, what can you tell us about that?
Sure. Friendly Spire, it's about this guy. His name is Guy Friendly, and he's a veteran of the first Gulf War. Most of my plays take place before 2001 because I don't know what to do with cell phones. And so he's a veteran of the first Gulf War, and where he's seen some really terrible things, and he's become a shut-in. And then after an evening where violence is done to him, he kind of spirals out of control and goes through this this incredible journey, you know, in his head, where he tries to make sense out of exactly what has happened, leading to both the death of his brother and the failing of his own marriage. But he also has a guide. His best friend kind of comes in and finds him in a fevered state. And rather than, like, you know, smacking him and say, "Hey, dude, wake up, you're hallucinating," or "Hey, stop it," the friend's like, "Okay, I guess we're going to take this journey together." And so they take a journey together. And so it's a tale of friendship and remorse and hope. It was produced, had a workshop production at Classic City Fringe Festival in 2016. And then I received a full production with Barter Theater, Lord C in Abingdon, Virginia, in 2017. It previously won the 2015 Appalachian Festival of Playwrights and Plays up at Barter. It was a semifinalist for the Princess Grace Playwrights Foundation Award, and a semifinalist for a few other awards, a few other honors, and a finalist for the Knodal Playwriting Prize in University of Arkansas. So it's gotten some pretty word of mouth. It did well in Virginia. I'm hoping it does well in New York. The 14th Street Y is home to LABA, and LABA is presenting, you know, had a call for plays that they want to do a season of plays dealing with war and peace, or theater pieces dealing with war and peace. And so I talked with Rising Sun Performance Company. We decided to enter Friendly's Fire for consideration. And so LABA said yes, and they're going to co-produce the play. It opens May 3rd, 2019, and it will run until May 19th. It's directed by Anna Hogan, who just won an award with Ikea Skidieri for their work on a new play called Elephant, not one of my own space play called Elephant at the Planet Connections this year. So yeah, we're looking forward to it. We're in our planning stages, and we're looking forward to taking this ride again.
Well, great. So two last questions here for you. Are you currently working on another play that we can be looking forward to? And if so, what can you tell us about it?
Well, I've got a few, so I'll try to focus on two. One is called Dead Movement, which had a rehearsed reading with the Rising Sun Performance Company at the Times Square Center a couple years ago, and then had a stage reading here with Classic City Fringe Festival, and it just had a production with Onion Man Productions in Chambly, as with liner notes. And that's more of a surreal, slightly autobiographical, slightly dark, slightly funny kind of piece about a hotel. Somebody described it as a goth hot L Baltimore. I'll take it.
Right.
So I'm hoping to get that one out a bit more. And then I have a brand new play, which will have a reading with Classic City Fringe Festival, directed by Jake Hunsbusher at the end of October. That play is called Tracks. And it deals with the economic fallout and the rise of the opioid crisis in the Hudson Valley, New York, in the 1990s. But of course, it's by me, so you can expect appearances by Johnny Appleseed, the Headless Horseman, and some other fun mythical characters of the Northeast.
Of course, we wouldn't expect anything else other than those. So that's fantastic. Okay, so how can people follow your writing adventures? Are you on social media?
I am. On Twitter. I'm going to forget my Twitter name right now. I believe it's just John Patrick Gray 76. I have a Facebook page you can like. So if you search for John Patrick Gray, and if something comes up that you can like, go ahead and like that. I have a website, www.johnpatrickbray.com. And I do not have an Instagram, but my friends have been telling me I take so many darn pictures on my phone that I probably should open an Instagram. But for right now, those are the best ways to find me.
All right. Terrific. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode. If you'd like to purchase any of John's plays, they're on Amazon.com, and you can read the first half of his plays or any of Next Stage Press's works on our website at www.nextstagepress.net. Also, if you're hearing this podcast for the first time, you can find the other episodes on iTunes or Podomatic, and now we're on Spotify as well. Just search Next Stage Press and hit subscribe, and as always, they're free to listen to and free to share with the world through the wonderful marvel that is social media. And please leave us a review so that we can keep bringing you the types of podcasts you want to hear. If you'd like to get in touch with me, I can be reached on Twitter at Gene Cato or by email at genecato@nextstagepress.net. And feel free to follow the Next Stage Press on Twitter at Next Stage Press or on our Facebook page at NS Press Podcast. Join us next time when we'll talk to Denver playwright Rebecca Gorman O'Neill about her play The Greater Good, which gives us a terrifying look at the future, as well as her association with Antodo 2 Theater Company, which produces works exclusively written by women. Until then, keep writing plays, keep reading plays, and keep going to the theater and supporting new work. And John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Goodbye, everybody.